as though to speed the arrival of the car. The elevator doors opened and two pregnant mothers emerged side by side, pushing strollers ahead of them. The younger woman pushed her way past them, and one turned to look at her with annoyance. Another shopper approached in haste and called out, not wanting the doors to close before she had a chance to get on. One of the pregnant women reached back and put a hand against the doors to stall their closure. The shopper smiled gratefully as she stepped in, murmuring her thanks. The elevator doors closed as the two pregnant women ambled off toward the infant and children's wear. I made a beeline for the fire exit, laid one hip against the push bar, and entered the stairwell. I went down as rapidly as possible, dropping two steps at a time, while I calculated the younger woman's escape alternatives. She could take the elevator as far as the second floor or the first, or proceed all the way down to the basement level, where the parking garage was located. If she realized I was on her tail, she might leave the elevator on two and take the escalator up to three again in hopes of throwing me off course. On the other hand, she probably wanted to get out of the store as quickly as possible, which made the first floor the obvious choice. Once she slipped into the busy mall, she could doff the white linen jacket and the red beret and hurry away, knowing there was no chance I'd reach the exit doors before she'd been swallowed into the crowd. I reached the second floor landing and used the railing as a pivot as I took the next flight down, muffled footsteps echoing as I ran. Another possibility occurred to me as I galloped down the stairs. If she'd arrived at the store with an eye to a leisurely day of thieving, she might have wanted her car handy with a trunk capacious enough to accommodate multiple shopping bags stuffed with stolen goods. How many times had I seen shoppers dropping bags off at the car before returning to the mall? I rounded the landing at the first floor and bypassed the exit as I sped toward the parking garage. I took the final short flight of stairs in two leaps. The door at the bottom opened into a small carpeted lobby with offices visible behind a set of glass doors. The exit doors slid open as I reached them and then politely closed behind me. I paused to take in the vast underground garage. I was standing in a dead-end bay, circumscribed by a short loop of parking spaces coveted because of their proximity to the store's entrance. I've watched cars circle endlessly, hoping to snag one of these treasured slots. Now all of them were taken, and there was no sign of backing out taillights to suggest a vacancy coming due. I trotted into the empty lane and scanned the straightaway that shot to the far end of the garage, where a shadowy two-lane ramp curved up to the street level above. The space was illuminated by a series of flat fluorescent fixtures mounted against a low concrete ceiling. There was no sound of running footsteps. Cars entered and departed at regular intervals. Ingress was impeded by the need to push a button and wait for an automated ticket to emerge from the slot. Egress was governed by the need to surrender that same ticket on exiting, pausing long enough for the attendant to check the date and timestamp to see if parking fees were due. To my right was the nearest exit, a short upward incline that spilled out onto Chapel Street. The sign posted at the top read, "Watch for pedestrians, no left turn." As I waited, two cars passed me, one coming down the ramp, the other on its way up. I gave the departing driver a quick look, but she wasn't the woman I was looking for. I heard a car engine spark to life. I squinted and tilted my head as I tried to track the sound to its origin. In the artificial light of the garage with its gloomy acres of concrete, it was almost impossible to pinpoint. I turned and looked behind me, where 20 feet away, I caught the wink of red taillights and a white flash of backup lights. A black Mercedes sedan accelerated out of the slot, swung sharply, and careened backward in my direction. The younger woman had an arm over the front seat, zeroing in on me, the car zigzagging as she corrected her aim. The rear of the Mercedes fishtailed and bore down on me with surprising speed. I leaped between two parked cars, banging my shin against the front bumper of one. I stumbled and toppled sideways, extending my right hand in hopes of breaking my fall. I went down on one shoulder and then staggered to my feet again. The woman rammed the gear into drive and took off with a chirp of her tires. Of necessity, she slowed at the kiosk, handing over her ticket while I limped gamely after her with no hope of catching up. The attendant glanced at her ticket and waved her on, apparently unaware that she just tried to run me down. The traffic arm lifted, and the woman sent me a satisfied smile as she sailed up the ramp and hung a left at the street. Wincing, I stopped and leaned over, putting my hands on my knees. I realized belatedly that my right palm was badly scraped and bleeding. My right shin throbbed, and I knew I'd be nursing a nasty bruise and a knot along the bone. I looked up as a man approached and handed me my shoulder bag, eyeing me with concern. "Are you all right? That woman nearly hit you." "I'm fine. Don't worry about it." "You want me to notify mall security? You really ought to file a report." I shook my head. "Did you catch the license plate?" "Well, no, but she was driving a Lincoln Continental. Dark blue, if that helps." I said, "Good call. Thanks." As soon as he was gone, I pulled myself together and went in search of my car. My shin throbbed and the palm of my hand stung where grit was embedded in the wound. I'd gained precious little for the price I'd paid. So much for the eyewitness account. I'd already identified the black Mercedes. It was the plate number I'd missed. Shit. Chapter 3. 15 minutes later, I was turning off Cabana Boulevard onto Albanil. I parked my Mustang half a block from my apartment and limped the rest of the way, still rerunning the episode in my head. It's amazing what you miss when someone's trying to score a traffic fatality at your expense. There was no point in berating myself for failing to pick up the number on the license plate. Well, okay, I chided myself a little bit, but I didn't go overboard. I could only hope the woman in the black pantsuit had actually been arrested and was at the county jail being booked, fingerprinted, and photographed. If she was a novice, a night in jail might cure her of the urge to steal. If she was an old hand at shoplifting, maybe she'd lay off, at least until her court date came up. Her friend might also take a lesson. Turning up the front walk, I saw that Henry had already put his garbage bins at the curb, though the regular weekly pickup wasn't until Monday. I went through the squeaky gate and around to the rear, where I unlocked my studio door and dropped my shoulder bag on a kitchen stool. I turned on the desk lamp and pulled up my pant leg to examine my injury, a move I immediately regretted. My shin now sported a bony protrusion that had an eerie sheen to it, flanked by two wide bruises the color of eggplant. I don't like playing tag with a luxury sedan. I don't like being forced to leap between cars as though rehearsing a stunt. I was more pissed off in retrospect than I'd been at the time. I know there are people who believe you should forgive and forget. For the record, I'd like to say I'm a big fan of forgiveness, as long as I'm given the opportunity to get even first. I crossed the patio to Henry's place. The kitchen lights were on, and the glass-paned door stood open, though the screen was hooked shut. I picked up the scent of split-pea soup simmering on the stove. Henry was on the phone. I tapped on the frame to let him know I was there. He waved me in, and when I pointed at the door, he stretched the long, coiled telephone line to the maximum to unhook the screen. He went back to his conversation, which he conducted while gesturing with a ticket envelope, saying, "By way of Denver, I have an hour and 30-minute layover. Connecting flight gets me in at 3:05. I left the return open so we can play that by ear." There was a pause while the other party responded in such loud tones I could almost distinguish the content from where I stood. Henry held the handset away from his ear and fanned himself with his itinerary, rolling his eyes. After a moment, he cut in. "That's fine. Don't worry about it. I can always take a cab. If I see you, I see you. If I don't, I'll show up at the house as soon as I can." The conversation went on for a bit while I held up my skinned palm, the butt of which was scored with skid marks. He peered at it closely and made a face. Still chatting, he tossed the plane ticket on the counter, opened a drawer, and took out a bottle of hydrogen peroxide and a box of cotton balls. When his conversation ended, he returned the handset to the wall-mounted cradle and motioned me into a chair. "How'd you do this?" I said, "Long story. and then regaled him with a condensed version of the shoplifting incident and my attempt to pick up an ID on the younger woman. "You should see my shin," I said. "It looks like somebody hit me with a tire iron. Weird thing is, I don't even know how it happened. One minute she's staring straight for me. Next instant, I'd levitated, getting out of her way. I can't believe you went after her. What were you going to do, make a citizen's arrest?" I hadn't thought that far ahead. I was hoping to pick up her plate number, but no such luck, I said. "What's going on? It sounds like you're taking a trip." "I'm flying to Detroit. Nell took a spill. Lewis called first thing this morning and woke me out of a sound sleep." "She fell? Well, that's not like her. She's usually steady as a rock." He saturated a cotton ball with peroxide and dabbed my wound. A light foam bubbled at the edge of the scrape. The wound no longer hurt, but there was something lovely about being tended to by a bona fide mother substitute. He frowned. "She was opening a can of tuna, and the cat was winding back and forth between her legs. You know how they do. She went to set his bowl on the floor, tumbled over him, and came down on her hip. Lewis said it sounded like a well-struck baseball flying out of the park. She tried to pull herself up, but the pain was excruciating. So the boys called 911. She went from the ER straight into surgery, which is when he called me. I contacted my travel agent as soon as the office opened, and she got me a seat on the first flight out." "What cat? I didn't know they had a cat." "I thought I told you about him. Charlie took in a stray a month ago. Skin and bones, from all reports. No tail and half of one ear gone. Lewis was adamant about turning the scruffy guy over to the pound, but Charlie and Elle ganged up and voted him down. Lewis made his usual dire predictions. Mange, cat scratch, fever, septicemia, ringworm. And sure enough, this morning, tragedy struck, as he put it. Most of his report was taken up with I told you so's." He returned the first aid items to the drawer. "But Nell's okay." Henry wagged his hand. "Lewis says they put a 14-inch titanium pin in her femur, and I don't know what else. It was tough to keep him on point. I gather she'll be in the hospital for a few days and then go to rehab." "Well, the poor thing." Henry's sister Nell was 99 years old and ordinarily the picture of health. Not only active, but vigorous. The only other hospitalization I'd heard about was 19 years before when she'd developed female trouble and had undergone a hysterectomy. Afterwards, she declared that while at 80 she was fully reconciled to the notion that her childbearing days were done, she was sorry to lose the organ. She never had a body part removed, and she'd been hoping to leave the world with all her original equipment intact. Nell had never married and had no children of her own. Her four younger brothers had served as surrogates, aggravating the life out of her, as kids are meant to do. Henry, as the youngest, was more closely allied with Nell than any of the intervening sibs. The two of them were like bookends, holding the three middle brothers upright. After Nell, Henry was the take-charge member of the family. In truth, he sometimes served in that capacity in my life as well. William, age 89 and senior to Henry by 1 year, had relocated to Santa Teresa 4 years before and had subsequently married my friend Rosie, who owns the neighborhood tavern where I hang out. As for Lewis and Charlie, still living at home, they were entirely capable of taking care of themselves. It was Nell, the temporary invalid, they'd find difficult to accept. All the boys deferred to her, giving her full command over their lives and well-being. If she was out of commission, even briefly, Lewis and Charlie would be lost. "What time's your flight?" 6:30. Means getting up at 4:30, but I can sleep on the plane." "Is William going with you?" "I talked him out of it. He's been complaining about his stomach, and the news of Nell's fall threw him into a tizzy. If he went, I'd end up with two patients on my hands." William was a born-again hypochondriac and couldn't be trusted around the sick or infirm. Henry had told me that in the months before Nell's hysterectomy, William suffered from monthly cramps, which were later diagnosed as irritable bowel syndrome. "I'll be happy to take you to the airport," I said. "Perfect. That way I won't have to leave my car in the long-term parking lot." He put the oven on preheat and fixed a blue-eyed gaze on me. "You have dinner plans?" Forget it. I don't want you worrying about me. Have you packed? Not yet, but I still have to eat. After supper, I'll haul out a suitcase. I have a load in the dryer, so I can't do much anyway until it's done. Chardonnays in the fridge. I poured myself some white wine and then took out an old-fashioned glass and filled it with ice. He keeps his blackjack in a cabinet near the sink, so I added three fingers. I looked at him and he said, "And this much water." He held his thumb and index finger close together to specify the amount. I added tap water and passed him the drink, which he sipped while he continued dinner preparations. I set the table. Henry pulled four homemade dinner rolls from the freezer and put them on a baking sheet. As soon as the oven peeped, he slid the pan in and set the timer. Henry is a retired commercial baker, who even now produces a steady stream of breads, rolls, cookies, cakes, and cinnamon buns so tasty they make me whimper. I sat down at the table, catching sight of a list of items he needed to handle before he left town. He'd already canceled the newspaper, picked up his cleaning, and rescheduled a dental appointment. He'd drawn a happy face on that line. Henry hates dentists and postpones his visits for as long as he can. He'd crossed out a reminder to himself to roll out the garbage bins for Monday pickup. He'd also put his interior lights on timers and shut down the water valve to the washer so the machine wouldn't suffer a mishap in his absence. He intended to ask me to water his plants as needed and cruise through his place every 2 days to make sure things were okay. I checked that item off the list myself. By then, the salad had been made and Henry was ladling soup into bowls. We snarfed down our food with the usual dispatch, competing for the land speed record. So far, I was ahead. After supper, I helped him with the dishes and then went back to my place, toting a brown paper bag full of perishables he'd passed along to me. In the morning, I woke at 5, brushed my teeth, washed my face, and pulled a knit cap over my mop of hair, which was mashed flat on one side and stood straight up everywhere else. Since it was Saturday, I wouldn't be doing my usual 3-mile jog, but I stepped into sweats and running shoes for simplicity's sake. Henry was waiting on the back patio when I emerged. He looked adorable, of course, chinos and a white dress shirt with a blue cashmere sweater worn over it. His white hair, still damp from the shower, was neatly brushed to one side. I could picture widder women in the airport waiting room angling for the chance to sit next to him. We chit-chatted on the 20-minute drive to the airport, which allowed me to repress the feelings of melancholy I experienced the minute I dropped him at the gate. I made sure his flight was on time, then I waved once and took off, swallowing the lump in my throat. For a hard-ass private eye, I'm a weenie when it comes to saying goodbye. Home again, I pulled off my shoes, stripped my sweats, crawled into bed, and pulled the covers up to my chin. The plexiglass skylight above my bed was streaked with the pink and blue streamers of a burgeoning dawn when I finally closed my eyes and sank into the warmth. I woke again at 8 o'clock, showered, dressed in my habitual jeans, turtleneck, and boots, and watched a segment of the news while I finished my cereal and washed my bowl. Neither the newspaper nor the local television station made reference to the shoplifting episode, not even as a tiny two-line report on an inside page. I would have appreciated learning the woman's name and age along with some hint of what had happened to her. Was she arrested and charged, or kicked out of the store and told never to return? Policy varied from one retail establishment to the next, and ranged from warn and release to criminal prosecution, the alternative I'd vote for if it were up to me. I don't know why I thought the disturbance would warrant a news story. Crimes take place daily that don't generate a smidge of interest in the public at large. Minor matters of burglary and theft are relegated to the back page. Break-ins reported by neighborhood with a cursory list of items stolen. Vandalism might be elevated to a 1-inch squib. Depending on the political climate, taggers might or might not be accorded column space. White-collar crime, especially fraud and embezzlement of public funds, are more likely than murder to inspire irate letters to the editor and the denunciation of corporate greed. My shoplifter and her co-conspirator were probably long gone, my bruised shin the only testimony that remained painful witness to their skullduggery. For the foreseeable future, I'd be scanning pedestrians, alert to the presence of any black Mercedes sedan, all in hopes of spotting one or the other of the two women. Mentally, I sharpened the metal toes of my boots. In the meantime, I loaded my car with cleaning equipment in anticipation of my Saturday chores. I was at the office by 9, happy to find a parking place out front. There was a period of time when I'd hired a service, the mini-maids, to clean my office once a week. There were usually 4 of them, though never the same 4 twice. They wore matching T-shirts and arrived toting mops, dust cloths, vacuums, and assorted janitorial products. The first time they cleaned for me, they took an hour, their efforts thorough and conscientious. I'd been thrilled to pay the $50 because the windows shone, all the surfaces gleamed, and the carpet was as clean as I'd ever seen it. Every visit thereafter, they accelerated the process until they became so efficient, they were in and out again in 15 minutes, dashing off to the next job as though their very lives depended on it. Even then, much of their time on the premises was spent chatting among themselves. Once they departed, I'd find a dead fly on the windowsill, spider silk trailing from the ceiling, and coffee grounds, or were those ants, littering the counter in my kitchenette. I figured $50 for 15 minutes, fraught with giggles and gossip, was the equivalent of $200 an hour, which was 4 times more than I earned myself. I fired them with a giddy sense of piety and thrift. Now I made a point of going in at intervals to do the job myself. It wasn't until I hauled my vacuum cleaner from the trunk of my car that I noticed the fellow sitting on my steps smoking a cigarette. His blue jeans had faded to white at the knee, and his brown boots were scuffed. He had wide shoulders, and his shirt was a royal blue satin, unbuttoned to the waist, the sleeves rolled up above his biceps. The name Dodie was scrawled in cursive along his right forearm. For a moment, I drew a blank, and then his name popped to mind. He grinned, gold incisors flashing in his weathered face. "You don't recognize me," he remarked as I came up the walk. "I do, too. You're Pinky Ford. Last I heard, you were in jail. I've been a free man since last May. I admit I was picked up Friday on a DUI, but I got sprung. That's what friends are for, is how I look at it. Anyways, I had business over at the jail this morning, and seeing how I was in the neighborhood, I decided to stop by and see how you were doing. How you been?" His voice was raspy from a lifetime of smoking. "Fine, thanks. And you?" "Good enough," he said. He didn't seem to register the Hoover upright, and I didn't explain. It wasn't any of his business if I was working as a part-time char. He flipped his cigarette onto the walkway and stood up, brushing off his jeans. He was my height, 5'6", wiry, bow-legged, and brown from too much sun. His arms and chest were muscular, veins running across like piping. He'd been a jockey in his youth until he got tossed one time too many and decided he'd better find another line of work. He'd started smoking when he was 10, and continued the habit as an adult because it was the only way to keep his weight, including tack, under the 126 pounds required for the Kentucky Derby, which he'd ridden in twice. This was long before his personal fortunes had gone into reverse. He kept on smoking for much the same reason any habitual criminal does, to break up the time while he was in the joint. I put down my vacuum cleaner and unlocked the door, talking to him over my shoulder. "You're lucky you caught me. I don't usually come in on Saturdays." I ushered him into the office ahead of me, noting that his limp was pronounced. I knew how he felt. Pinky was in his 60s, coal black hair, black brows, and deep lines around his mouth. He sported the ghost of a mustache and the shadow of a goatee. There was a band of white on his left wrist where he'd shed a watch. "I'm about to put on a pot of coffee if you'd like a cup." "Couldn't hurt." After his passion for racing was squelched, his second calling was a long, inglorious career as a non-residential burglar. I did hear he'd eventually taken to burgling houses, but I hadn't had that confirmed. He was the man who'd given me a set of key picks in a leather case years before. essential tools on those occasions when a locked door stands between me and something I want. He'd hired me during one of his stints in prison when he'd been worried about his wife, the aforementioned Dodie, convinced she was dallying with the guy next door. She was actually being faithful, as far as I could tell, which I'd reported after sitting surveillance off and on for a month. He gave me the pics in lieu of payment, since his cash reserves were all illegally acquired and had to be returned. "Why burglary?" I asked once. He'd flashed me a modest smile. "I'm a natural. You know, because I'm a skinny guy and agile as a cat, I can squeeze in through places a lot of other fellows can't. Job's more physical than you'd think. I can do 100 one-arm push-ups, 50 either side." "Good for you," I'd said. "There's actually a trick to it, something a fellow taught me up in Soledad. You'll have to show me sometime." I put on a pot of coffee and went to my desk, where I sat down in my swivel chair and propped my feet on the edge. Meanwhile, Pinky remained standing, scanning my office with an eye to where the valuables might be kept. He shook his head. "This is a come-down. Last I saw, you had an office over on State Street. Nice location, very nice. This, I don't know so much. I guess I'm used to seeing you in classier digs." "I appreciate the vote of confidence," I remarked. With Pinky, there wasn't any point in taking offense. He might be a repeat offender, but he was never guilty of subterfuge. When the coffee was done, I filled two mugs and handed him one before I returned to my swivel chair. Pinky finally settled into one of my two visitors' chairs, sucking in hot coffee with a series of slurping sounds. "This is good. I like it strong." "Thanks. How's Dodie?"
"Good. She's great. She's gone into direct sales like an entrepreneur."
"Selling what?"
"Nothing door to door. She's a personal beauty consultant for a big national company. Glorious Womanhood. You probably heard of it."
"Don't think so," I said.
"Well, it's bigger than Mary Kay. It's Christian-based. She sets up these home parties for bunches of women. Not our place, but someone else's, where they serve food. Then she'll do makeovers, demonstrating products you can order on the spot. Last month she edged out the regional manager for top sales."
"Sounds like she's doing well. I'm impressed."
"Me too. I guess the regional manager was fit to be tied. Nobody ever beat her out before. But Dodie's purpose-driven when she puts her mind to it. Used to be when I was gone, she'd get all mopey and depressed. I'd be doing hard time, and she'd be laying around watching TV and eating fatty snacks. We'd talk on the phone, and I'd try to get her motivated, you know, building up her self-esteem. But it never did much good. Then she hears about this business opportunity, similar to a franchise or something like that. I didn't think much of it at the time, because she never stuck to anything until this came along. This past year, she's earned enough to buy a Cadillac and qualify for a free vacation cruise."
"Where to?"
"The Caribbean. St. Thomas. And around in there. A flight to Fort Lauderdale and then on to the ship."
"You're going with her?"
"Sure, if I can get myself set. Two of us have never been on a vacation together. It's tough to make plans when we never know if I'll be in jail or out.
Something like this, I don't want to be dependent on her money-wise.
The trip is all expenses paid, but there's incidentals. Onshore excursions and the casino when you're out at sea. Two of the six nights, formal wear is required, so I'll have to rent me a tux. Can you picture it? I always swore I'd have to be dead before you caught me in one. But she's all excited about the dress she had made. Not that she'd show me. She says it'd be bad luck, like seeing a bride decked out in her wedding finery before you get to the church. It's a knockoff of a gown Debbie Reynolds wore one year to the Academy Awards. There's even a good possibility she'll be crowned Glorious Woman of the Year."
"Wouldn't that be something?" I said. I let him go on, telling the story his way. I knew he had a problem. Why else would he be here? But the faster I pushed him, the sooner I'd be in the bathroom scrubbing the toilet bowl. I figured that could wait.
"Anyways, I'm giving you the background. I assumed as much. Thing is, my wife's got this engagement ring. 1.5-carat diamond set in platinum, worth $3,000 easy. I know because I had it appraised 2 days after it came into my possession. This was in Texas some time ago. She hasn't been wearing it because she says it's too loose and bothers her every time she goes to wash her hands.
I can't wait to see where you're going with this.
Yeah, well, that's the other thing. She's lost a lot of weight. She looks like a runway model, only bigger in the tush. You probably don't remember, but she used to be, well, I won't say fat, but on the far side of plump. The past 15 months, she's taken off 60 pounds. I came home, I didn't recognize her. That's how good she looks. Wow. I love success stories. How'd she manage it? Diet supplement. An over-the-counter upper that's not FDA-regulated because, technically speaking, it's not a drug. She's so buzz all the time, she forgets to eat. She has to be on the go every minute or she gets whacked out from too much nervous energy. As a side benefit, the houses never look so good. Drop of a hat, she'll do all the windows inside and out. Anyways, she tossed the ring in her jewelry box 6 months back and she hasn't touched it since. Now she wants to have it sized so she can wear it on the cruise. She's all stressed out because she can't find it anywhere, so I said I'd look.
You hawked it.
Pretty much. I want to do right by her, but I'm low on funds and it's tough to find work. I don't like taking handouts from the woman I love. Problem is, the skills I have aren't exactly in demand. What happened was, I put together a stake, using the ring as collateral on a 4-month loan. This was way last spring after I got out of Soledad. I went down to Santa Anita to play the ponies. I don't get to the track every couple of months. I tend to brood. I'm a moody guy to begin with, and the nags take my mind off. Let me guess. You lost your shirt, and now you need to get the ring back before she figures out what you did. There you have it. I couldn't come up with the principal, so I paid the interest and rolled it over for another 4 months. Now that's up, and the 10-day grace runs out Tuesday of next week. I don't pay, that's the last I see of it, which would break my poor heart. Hers, too, if she found out. How much? $200. That's all you got for a ring worth $3,000? Sad but true. The guy lowballed me on the deal, but it's not like I had any choice. I can't borrow from a bank. I mean, picture the loan docs, me wanting $200 for 120 days. Can't be done. So now I owe the two in cash, plus another 25 in interest. Be honest about it, I might not get the money back to you right away. I mean, eventually, sure. I stared at him while I considered his request. I had cash in my wallet, so I wasn't worried about that. The key picks he'd given me had served me well, as had the tutorial he'd provided before he got sent up. Also, counting in his favor was the fact that I liked the man. Profession aside, he was a good-hearted soul. Even a burglar suffers the occasional financial woes. Finally, I said, how about this? I won't give you the cash, but I'll go with you to the pawn shop and pay the guy myself. His look was pained. You don't trust me? Sure I do, but let's not tempt fate. You're tough. I'm a realist. Your car or mine? Mine's in the shop. You can drop me off there afterward and I'll pick it up. Chapter 4 Santa Teresa Jewelry and Loan is located 2 doors down from a gun shop on Lower State Street. There's a gas station across the street and a tattoo parlor around the corner. The area is short on tourists and long on bums, perfect for urban renewal if the city ever gets around to it. The pawn shop itself is narrow, wedged between a thrift shop and a packaged liquor store. Pinky held the door for me and I went in. Inside, the air carried the faint scent of alcohol, which stirred when the door closed behind us. A percentage of the cash out on loan probably traveled next door to the liquor store, where the exchange rate was keyed to red wine of the lowest denomination. A green neon sign with the three-ball symbol for a pawn shop sputtered at a speed that would cause seizures in the unsuspecting. To my right, high up on the wall, 15 hocked paintings had been mounted,
artfully arranged around a security camera, angled on the two of us. This allowed me to view myself in full color as seen from above, me checking out the camera while the camera checked me. In my jeans and turtleneck, I looked like a homeless person down on her luck. Below the paintings, shelves held an assortment of power tools, air tools, hand tools, nail guns, and socket wrench sets. The lower shelves were crowded with second-hand electronics. Clocks, headphones, stereo speakers, turntables, radios, and big clunky television sets with screens the size of the windows in airplanes. On the left, a row of guitars hung behind the counter, along with enough violins, flutes, and horns to constitute a small-town orchestra. A series of glass display cases ran the length of the shop, holding tray after tray of rings, watches, bracelets, and coins. Dispirited household items, a child's bone china tea set, a ceramic vase, a cut crystal figurine, and four graduated teak nesting bowls sat together on a shelf. There were no books, no weapons, and no articles of clothing. This was where once cherished items came to roost, sentiment surrendered for cash. I pictured a constant round robin of relinquishment and redemption, items converted into currency and then claimed again as personal fortunes improved. People moved, people died, people retired into nursing homes where there was so little space that much of what they owned had to be sold, given away, or abandoned at the curb. The place was doing better business than I'd expected. One man took down a wall-mounted leaf blower that he examined for some time before he carried it to the counter to purchase. A second man browsed the electronics, while a third, at the rear, labored to affix his signature to a document with a shaky hand. Of the four employees I counted, two greeted Pinky by name. The woman who stepped forward to assist him was middle-aged with wavy red-gold hair that she parted on the side. A 2-inch-wide swath of gray hair showed at the roots. Her eyeglasses were framed in thick black plastic that seemed too emphatic for her hair coloring. She wore slacks and a white cotton blouse with a bow at the collar, apparently meant to disguise the width of her neck, which put her in a league with weightlifters given to heavy steroid use. She winked at him, held up a finger, and then retired to the back room. She returned moments later with a padded tray covered in black velvet. "This is June," he said of her, and then nodded at me. "Kinsey Milhone, she's a private detective." We shook hands. "Nice meeting you," I said.
"Same here."
Pinky watched us as she untied a ribbon and opened two cloth flaps. In the center was the ring, which to me looked small and unremarkable. Then again, Pinky never claimed it was a family heirloom, at least not in his family. The diamond was the size of a wee rhinestone stud, not that I owned anything so grand. He smiled at me shyly.
"You want to try it on?"
"Sure." I slipped it on my finger and held it to the light, turning it this way and that.
"Gorgeous."
"Isn't it?" "Absolutely," I said, practicing my lying skills. Shortly after that, we got down to business. I handed over the $225 in cash while the two of them dealt with the paperwork. Afterward, I drove Pinky to the car repair shop, which was 6 blocks away. As I pulled over to the curb, I peered past him through the passenger side window. There was no sign of activity. The doors to the service bays were down and the office was dark.
"Are you sure someone's there?" "Doesn't look like it, does it? I must have misunderstood."
"You want me to drop you off at your place?"
"No need. I'm up on Paseo. It's an easy walk."
"Don't be silly. It's right on my way." I drove 8 blocks north on Chapel until I reached Paseo, where I hung a left. He pointed to a dark gray frame duplex, and I slowed to a stop. There was no room to park, so he got out while the engine idled. He closed the car door and waved me on. I wiggled my fingers at him in the rearview mirror by way of a farewell, though he was gone by then. I returned to the office, where I donned a pair of rubber gloves and gave the premises a thorough going over. Then I went back to my place and started a load of laundry. As a youngster, I was taught that Saturday was for chores, and you couldn't go out to play until your room was clean. The critical lessons in life hold sway whether you like it or not. 5:30, I put on my windbreaker, slid my paperback novel down to my shoulder bag, locked the studio, and walked the half block to Rosie's. Another woman approached the entrance at the same time I did, and we reached for the door simultaneously. When our eyes met, I pointed at her. "You're Claudia," she smiled, "and you're Kinsey Milhone. 12 pairs of size small high-cut briefs." "I can't believe you remembered. You were just in yesterday." I held the door, allowing her to pass in front of me. Her hair was coal black, shiny, and carelessly arranged. Her eyes were bright brown, and her gaze was direct. She was probably in her late 40s and stylishly put together. She wore a two-button designer jacket, well-cut slacks, and a crisp white shirt. Working for Nordstrom's gave her access to the latest fashions, as well as an employee discount. I said, "You must live close by. I can't think why else you'd frequent the place." She smiled. "Actually, we live on the Upper East Side. Drew's the manager of the Ocean View Hotel. We meet here on nights when he's working late and only has a short dinner break. I got off work early and decided to come in and wait for him. What about you?" "I'm half a block down. I'm here two or three nights a week when I'm too lazy to cook." "Same for me. Nights he's not home, I tend to graze," she said. "You want to join me for a drink?" "Sure, I'd like that. I've been dying to find out what happened to the shoplifter." "I'm glad you were there when Mr. Coslow showed up." "Absolutely. I loved every minute of it. What are you drinking?" "Gin and tonic." "I'll be right back." William had seen me come in, and by the time I reached the bar, he'd already poured me a glass of bad Chardonnay. I waited until he'd made Claudia's gin and tonic, and then carried both drinks to the table and sat down. I wasn't sure how much Claudia was at liberty to disclose about store business, but I took up the conversation where we'd left it, behaving as though the matter was open for discussion. I said, "I thought I was seeing things when she slid those pajamas in her bag." "What nerve." "I thought she was acting odd the minute she showed up, so I kept an eye on her. Shoplifters always think they're cool, but they tend to telegraph their intent. I just finished ringing up a customer when you came up and told me what was going on. When I called security, Ricardo picked her up on the monitor and notified Mr. Coslow. He sent me to wait by the second floor escalator in case she came down. Ordinarily, he'd have handled the situation on his own, but there was an occasion not too long ago where a female customer accused him of using excessive force. It wasn't true, of course, but since then, he's made a point of having a witness on hand. I heard the alarm go off, but I never saw the follow-up. Was she arrested? Oh, yes, ma'am, she said. He caught up with her in the mall and asked her to accompany him into the store. She played dumb, like she had no idea what he wanted with her. They usually start out pretending to cooperate. So she did as he asked, though she protested the whole time. About what? She had the stolen items right there. He didn't ask her to open the shopping bag until they reached the security offices. No one wants to subject a customer to public embarrassment in case it turns out to be a bad stop. Once in private, he had her empty the contents of her bag, and out came the two pairs of pajamas and, oops, no receipt. Then he asked her to open her purse, and there was the lace teddy, again with no evidence she'd paid, completely baffling to her. I can't believe she had the gall to deny it. That's the standard M.O. Did you ever see the surveillance tape that shows the nurse's aide stealing money from an elderly patient? Once in a while, they run it on one of those true crime shows. You can see the aide clear as day. She gets into the woman's purse and takes the cash, which she stops to count before sticking it in her pocket. When the police showed her the tape, she sat right there with the detective, swearing up and down she didn't do it. Falsely accused. You got it. Same thing here. At first, she was all innocence. Man, well, talk about irate. She was a loyal Nordstrom's customer. She'd been shopping there for years. She couldn't believe he'd accuse her of stealing when she did no such thing. He said he hadn't accused her of anything. He was just asking her to account for the items in her possession. She said she certainly hadn't stolen them. Why would she do that when she had money in her wallet? She insisted she intended to buy the items, but then changed her mind. She had an appointment and she was in a hurry, so she ended up leaving the store without realizing she hadn't returned the items to the display. Mr. Coslow didn't say a word. He just let her run on because he knew he had her on tape. She went from huffy to belligerent, full speed ahead, yelling about her rights. She was going to contact her attorney. She'd sue the store for slander and false arrest. He was polite, but he didn't budge an inch. She broke down at that point and started sobbing. You've never seen anyone so pitiful in your life. She just about got down on her knees, begging him to let her go. The tears were the only part of the whole performance I thought was sincere. When that didn't work, she tried to bargain her way out. She offered to pay for the items and said she'd sign a conditional release. She also swore she'd never come in again. On and on it went. She used the phrase, conditional release. She did. Sounds like she's an old hand at this. Or how'd she know the term? Oh, she knew what notes to hit. Not that it did any good. Mr. Coslow had already told Ricardo to call the police, so he said she might as well calm down and save her arguments for the judge. That set off a whole new round of weeping and wailing. I didn't see the end of it because I went back to the floor when the officer arrived. Ricardo told me by the time they put her in the cop car, she was white as a sheet. Were you aware she was working with someone else? Claudia seemed taken aback. You're not serious. There were two of them? Absolutely. You might have noticed her partner without realizing who she was, a younger woman in a dark blue dress. Claudia shook her head. Don't think so. When I first saw them, they were standing together, chatting. I mistook her for a sales clerk. I assumed the younger one was a Nordstrom's employee and the older a customer. Then I realized the second woman had a shopping bag of her own. So I figured they were both customers making idle conversation. Probably deciding what to take. I wouldn't be surprised. After that, they split up, and by the time your security guy arrived, the other woman had gone off to the ladies' room. She was on her way back when she caught sight of her friend stepping onto the escalator with Mr. Coslow hard on her heels. She knew exactly what was going on. She went straight back to the ladies' room and locked herself in a stall. Then she clipped the price tags off the articles she'd cribbed and tossed them in the trash. I went in there right afterward, and when I saw what she'd done, I made a beeline for the fire stairs and followed her, but not fast enough. She managed to peel out of the parking garage before I got a look at her license plate. Funny you should mention the tags. Ricardo told me the cleaning crew found tags when they were picking up trash. The supervisor turned them over to Mr. Coslow, and he included them in his report. I think both he and Ricardo assumed it was the same woman. Well, if he needs a corroborating witness, I'd be happy to oblige. I doubt he'll take you up on it, but if the DA files charges, you can talk to him. I just hope the one woman gets nailed, even if her pal got away. You and me both. At that point, Claudia's husband arrived, and after a brief introduction, I excused myself. I returned to the bar, and when I asked for a second glass of wine, William caught sight of the skid marks across my right palm. What happened to you? I looked down and made a wry face, holding up my hand to show him the full effect. I fell while I was chasing a thief. I gave him the short version of the incident, and then, since there was so little in it to recommend my private detecting skills, changed the subject. I was sorry to hear about Nell's tumble. Have you talked to her? Not yet. I had a call from Henry when he arrived at the house. He said his flight was uneventful and he was going to the hospital as soon as he dropped his bag. I'm glad he made it with no problems. How's she doing? Fair, at least from what I've been told. The head of the femur was broken off and the shaft was in pieces, probably the result of osteoporosis. Well, that wouldn't surprise me at 99 years old. Henry told me about the pin they put in. His tone turned from somber to gloomy. Let's just hope it ends there. If she's immobilized for any length of time, her muscles will atrophy, and she'll develop bed sores. Next comes pneumonia, and after that... He fixed me with a bleak look and let the sentence trail off. I'm sure they'll get her up within a day. Isn't that the current thinking? One can only hope. You know the theory about bad things coming in threes. There was something else bad? I'm afraid so. I received a call from my doctor with the results of my latest blood tests. My blood sugar's elevated. The doctor said 50% of people in the same range end up with diabetes in 5 years. From somewhere under the bar, he pulled out a piece of paper and placed it in front of me, pointing at the relevant column. Normal for glucose was 65 to 99. His was 106. I had no idea if that put him in the danger zone, but he seemed to think so. I said, "Wow, what's the doctor suggesting?" "Nothing. He did mention that stress hormones are sometimes responsible for an inappropriate elevation of blood glucose." I went straight to my Merck manual and looked it up. He gazed upward, apparently quoting directly. "Diabetic amyotrophy is found characteristically in elderly men, producing a predominant muscle weakness around the hip and upper leg." "And you have that?" "I've been experiencing a weakness off and on this past month, which is why I went to see him in the first place." After a thorough examination, he was at a loss. He had absolutely no idea what was wrong with me. He leaned forward. I saw him write "etiology unknown" on my chart. It was chilling. My Merck says the absence of a precise diagnostic marker for diabetes mellitus continues to be a problem. "Onset tends to be abrupt in children," it says, "insidious in older patients." I shudder to think of the word "insidious" applied to me. "But surely there's something you can do for yourself. What about dietary changes?" He gave me a pamphlet which I haven't had the heart to read. "In addition to muscle weakness, I've been having stomach problems." "Henry mentioned that last night." He lifted his brows. "Of course, abdominal tenderness is another indicator for diabetes, as is fruity breath." He cupped his hands around his mouth and blew. I thought he'd offer me a sniff, which I was prepared to decline. "Fortunately, it hasn't come to that. But I am urinating more frequently. I'm up half the night." "Don't tell me about the stream," I said hastily. "I thought that was related to your prostate." "That was my first thought as well. Now I'm not so sure." Mentally, I squinted, trying to judge the truth value of his claim. I knew he believed it, but was there foundation in fact? One of these days, despite his tendency to dramatize, William was going to be afflicted with something real. "Do you have any family history of diabetes?" I asked. "How would I know? There are only 5 of us left. The Sibs and I take after our mother's side of the family. Her maiden name was Tillman, hardy German stock. Our grandmother on our father's side was a Moritz by birth. There were 5 other brothers and sisters who carried her genetic line. They all died within days of each other in the influenza epidemic of 1917. Who knows what health problems they'd have developed had they lived? What's Rosie think about all this?" "She has her head in the sand as usual, convinced nothing's wrong. It's right there in the Merck, every word of it. Under endocrine disorders, page 1289. On the facing page, there's talk of precocious puberty, which I was mercifully spared." "I'm not sure you should consult medical texts on your own. Most of the terminology makes no sense to the average person." "I was a Latin scholar as a youth. Ad praesens ova cras pulissunt meliora." He fixed me with a look to see if I was following. My face must have been blank because he went on to translate. "Eggs today are better than chickens tomorrow." I let that one pass. "But what if you're misinterpreting? I mean, the doctor didn't actually say you were diabetic, did he?" "He's probably giving me time to adjust. Most doctors don't want to burden a patient in the early stages. I thought he'd order additional lab work, but apparently he couldn't see the point. He told his nurse to make me an appointment for the week after next. It's probably going to be like that from now on." "Well, if Henry's home by then, he should go with you for moral support. When you're upset, you don't always hear what's being said." Rosie opened a swinging kitchen door and stuck her head out.
I'm making stuffed kohlrabi. Whatever you got, it's gonna fix, she said to him. And then to me, you're gonna have some too, with mutton. Sauce is best I ever make.
I took the interruption as an opportunity to retire to my favorite booth, bad wine in hand. I shrugged off my jacket and slid into the seat, hoping I wouldn't get a splinter in my butt. I pulled out my paperback and found my place, trying to look engrossed so William wouldn't follow me across the room to amplify his complaints. I was apprehensive about dinner. Rosie's Hungarian by birth and favors strange native dishes, many composed of animal organs smothered in sour cream. Earlier that week, she'd served me sautéed sweetbreads, a calf's thymus gland, if you want the awful truth. I'd eaten with my usual oinky appetite. I was mopping up the plate with half a dinner roll when she told me what it was. Thymus gland? What could I do about it when I'd already eaten it? Short of running to the ladies' room to jam a fork down my throat, I was stuck. It didn't help that I'd enjoyed it. She appeared with my dinner plate, setting it down in front of me. She waited with her hands clasped while I tasted a small bite of meat and faked enthusiasm. She didn't seem convinced.
Yummy, I said. Really, it's fabulous.
She remained skeptical, but she had other orders coming up and she returned to the kitchen. Once she was gone, I picked up my fork and knife and started sawing away. The mutton required more work than I'd anticipated, but the effort took my mind off the sauce, which was not as sublime as she'd indicated. The kohlrabi looked like a little alien spacecraft and tasted like a cross between a turnip and cabbage, the perfect complement to the badly fermented sugar water I was using to wash it down. I wrapped a chunk of mutton in a paper napkin that I then tucked in my shoulder bag. I caught William's eye and made the universal gesture for the check. I exchanged a few parting remarks with Claudia and Drew, and then headed for home. I was in bed by 9, thinking that was the end of the shoplifting episode. Silly me. Chapter 5. Nora. For Nora, the weekend had started on a sour note. She'd spent the early part of the week in Beverly Hills, taking care of routine appointments. She'd had her hair done, manicure, pedicure, massage, and her annual physical, which she was happy to have out of the way. She returned to the house in Montebello on Thursday afternoon. She and Channing had bought their second home the year before, and she loved every minute of their time away. Though the new place was only 100 miles north of their permanent residence, she felt she was traveling to another country. She could hardly wait to get there. This was a second marriage for each of them. When she and Channing met, he had shared custody of his twin girls, age 13. Her son was 11. They'd decided against having children of their own, opting instead to keep life simple. Summers, all three kids would be under the same roof with them, and that was sufficient chaos, especially as puberty struck, bringing with it the squabbles, the shrieking, tears, accusations of unfairness, and doors slamming upstairs and down. While appreciating the current household peace, Nora looked back on that era with fondness. At least the family was intact, however bumptious and loud. Channing had intended to join her Friday in time for dinner and stay until Monday morning. At the last minute, however, he called to say that he'd be bringing the Lowe's. Abner was a senior partner in Channing's law firm and one of his best friends. Meredith was Abner's second wife, the woman responsible for the breakup of his first marriage 10 years before. He was a serial womanizer, currently cheating on Meredith with the woman who'd doubtless turn out to be wife number 3, if she was smart and played her cards right. Nora and Meredith had met in a jazzercise class early in their 15-year friendship, and they'd loved nothing better than dishing about the various scandals in their social set. They'd bonded initially over the revelation that the wife of a pretentious bank president had had when she returned home unannounced and caught her husband cross-dressing, decked out in an Armani suit and designer heels. On another occasion, a mutual acquaintance was accused of appropriating large sums of money from the charity for which she volunteered as treasurer. Charges were filed, but the case never went to trial. An agreement was reached, and the business was swept under the carpet. At least twice a year, some outrageous impropriety would come to light, and the two would busy themselves trading rumors and howling with delight. Nora and Meredith had built an entire relationship on salacious gossip. This allowed the two women to compare notes, test their mutual values, and reinforce shared attitudes to swap any number of snobbish put-downs. Not that they considered themselves snobs. Then Meredith met Abner, and within a year the two had abandoned their respective spouses. Nora and Channing had stood for them at a simple ceremony at City Hall, followed by an elegant lunch at the Bel Air Hotel. As Channing and Abner were such good friends, the two women became even closer. Nora had been a staunch support to Meredith after she'd caught Abner in the first affair. The irony wasn't lost on either one of them. They'd forged a bond based on the misfortunes of others, and Meredith's suffering now occupied front and center. Nora became her sounding board, counseling her during hour-long telephone conversations and drunken lunches, wherein Nora played life coach and marriage counselor, feeling wise and superior and above it all. Together they analyzed every nuance of Abner's infatuation with the other woman, who, to their way of thinking, was not only coarse, but had put herself in the hands of the wrong cosmetic surgeon. Problematic was the fact that Meredith loved the lifestyle Abner provided. So, once she'd exhausted her emotional responses, she managed to make her peace with his infidelity. Though he never admitted to the affair, he bought her an armload of expensive jewelry and took her on a Silver Seas cruise through the Mediterranean. With Meredith's discovery of affair number two, the same scenes played out. A renewed cycle of tears, rage, and vows of revenge continued during the next few months. Nora found herself bored, though it took her a while to admit it to herself. She wanted to be loyal and sympathetic, but the drama soon became tedious, and she was impatient with the ineffectual anguish and spite. Meredith would never file for divorce, so why make such a big deal of it? The breaking point was when Meredith made a scene at a dinner party, where the other woman was in attendance. The hostess quickly put a stop to Meredith's drunken catcalling, but not before she'd made a thorough fool of herself. This offended Nora, who thought Meredith's conduct was unseemly and unbecoming. Regardless of the righteousness of Meredith's position, it was a matter of etiquette. In their social circle, everybody was supposed to be too well-bred to expose any unhappiness to public view. Whatever their marital status, whether delirious or disaffected, couples are expected to maintain at least a facade of amicability. No sniping, no zingers, no hostility expressed as teasing or bantering. Nora realized that Meredith had become hooked on playing victim because she loved to occupy center stage. Nora confided this sentiment in a candid conversation with a mutual friend, a moment of openness that turned out to be a miscalculation on her part. She knew it was indiscreet to pass along information she should have kept to herself, but the other woman had brought it up, and Nora couldn't resist. Somehow Meredith had gotten wind of it, and she and Nora had had a huge falling out. Over time, they mended their fences, but Nora was uncomfortably aware of having failed her friend and was therefore happier keeping her at a distance. Channing had invited them once before without consulting Nora, and she had bitten her tongue. She'd spent 2 days walking on eggshells, and once Abner and Meredith were out the door, she'd made her feelings known. Jesus, Channing, the last thing in the world I want is her unloading on me. I feel sorry for her, but I don't want to be in the position of having to commiserate. If you can avoid inviting them again, I'd be grateful. This had apparently annoyed him, though his tone of voice was light. Just because you and Meredith had a parting of the ways doesn't mean Abner and I should be penalized. It's not a question of penalizing anyone. You have to admit it's uncomfortable knowing what Abner's up to. I mean, what if she asks me outright? What am I supposed to say? What he does and how she feels about it is none of our business. Maybe not, but the man's a shitheel. Agreed. Now let's drop the subject, please. From that point on, Nora had kept her observations to herself. She had no way to guess if Meredith knew about affair number three, and this put her in an awkward position of editing her words. She didn't like keeping secrets. Even though the friendship had cooled, she was conflicted. Should she raise the issue or not? If Meredith already knew about the liaison and Nora mentioned it, the weeping and hand-wringing would erupt